Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Autism Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Lauren Presti. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Amber. Good day, and thank you for calling into Cigna's Autism Awareness Series. My name is Lauren Presti, and I am the lead clinician for the autism team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you will not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of this conference, you will be transferred to a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. After this survey, you will be asked to answer questions on today's seminar. A handout for today's seminar is available online at www.cigna.com/autism. Scroll to the topics section in the middle of your page and click on today's topic labeled Help, My Child is a Picky Eater. Please note that not all policies cover today's topic. For more information about your policy and if it includes today's topic, please contact the autism team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Today I have the pleasure of introducing Dr. Melissa Olive. Missy is a board-certified behavioral analyst and the founder of Applied Behavioral Strategies in New Haven, Connecticut. Missy, thank you for being here today, and you're welcome to start the presentation.
Thank you, Lauren, and thank you for having me. I'm very excited to share what I know about feeding difficulties for kids with autism. Normally, I like to see who is listening to me, and I know since we're on phone, we can't do that, but I do hope that I can meet your needs, and, of course, you'll be able to contact me afterwards if you have specific questions. If you look on slide three, you see a cartoon, and I like to use cartoons because they tell us that it's happening in the real world. And in this little cartoon, the little guy says, if I eat three more pieces of meat and three more spoonfuls of peas, I want three puddings after. And that tells me that he has been through behavioral feeding, that someone has taught him to first do something before he can have something else. Now, what I do have to preface my talk with is this workshop is insufficient to prepare professionals to offer feeding services, and it's insufficient to prepare parents to address issues without support. And when I say issues, I mean severe issues. In my experience, we have run into some difficulties that if we did not have medical professionals available, we could have had emergency situation. So it is really important that you do your homework before you start and that you don't try to go it alone. We are going to talk about autism specifically and the feeding problems that are associated with it. We'll talk about the necessary assessments before we start therapy. And then we will talk about using ABA therapy to address feeding. And then we'll wrap up with how you can get funding because, like Lauren said, not every insurance policy covers it, so we'll talk about some other sources of funding as well as some additional resources before we have the Q&A. And I will stop about 15 minutes before we're scheduled to stop so that we can do that Q&A. Now, if you can take away one take-home point, I'm on slide six now. The thing I want you to know is that if your child is having picky eating problems, or if you're the professional involved, do not blame yourself. This is not about your parenting skills or your therapist skills. This is about a condition that is associated with autism. It dates all the way back to Dr. Tanner's original report where he noted the characteristics of 11 kids with autism. And out of those 11 kids, six of them, so that's over half, had severe feeding difficulties. So why the DSM has not included feeding as a component of autism is beyond me and other behavioral feeding specialists, but we do know that it presents in different ways among those kids. So, for example, case 1, case 8, and case 11 had long-standing concerns with feeding, like many of you. Case 4 and case 7 had histories of vomiting. And case 5 had such a severe issue that he was tube-fed. Now, keep in mind, this paper dates all the way back to the 1940s, right? And it was not common to have tube feeding in the 40s. So case 5 was a serious, serious issue. In our clinical practice today, we see a range of things. Mostly we see the extremely limited diet. I call it my all-white diet. That's my kids who eat chicken nuggets, goldfish, French fries. They lack color. And you might be thinking, well, goldfish has color. Well, it's added color. It's not necessarily a food that has color. Kids will also be on a crunchy, salty diet. Yesterday I went to consult on a little girl at her school, and you can't help but see the other kids in the classroom, and my little fella to the right of me was eating bacon. That was his lunch, bacon. And so it's not shocking to me, because I've had another child that I treated. All he ate was bacon and homemade gluten-free, dairy-free, soy-free waffles. That was the extent of his diet. We have kids who cannot get beyond puree foods, so they cannot handle any texture at all and can only handle the purees. We have kids that graze all day long, so instead of sitting and eating, they will actually eat and run through the house and slap and come back and eat some more. I've had other kids who will carry around a baggie of goldfish or a baggie of pretzels, and they'll eat on those all day long, but yet they won't eat a meal. I have kids that cannot hold a sandwich and bite it off, or hold a piece of pizza and bite it off. I have kids that don't want to touch food, but they will only eat it if it can be picked up by a fork or a spoon. But I also have kids who will only eat foods that come that they can pick up with their fingers, like they will not tolerate a utensil in their mouth. So we see a wide range. Now, if you look on slide 8, is classic, and it's classic not just for kids with autism. Even my children here in my home have this touching issue. And so I love how the mama dog is saying to the puppy, listen, they're all the same. It's okay if they touch each other. The problem with these feeding issues is that it leads to other long-term medical issues or mental health issues. Obviously, the child is going to miss meals, but there's a malnourishment issue where the child is not getting the appropriate nutrition. When you lack certain nutrients, then you crave other foods, and you get into this vicious cycle of eating the very things that you should not be eating or eating the things that aren't giving you what you need. We get failure to thrive or stunted growth. My own sibling is a classic example of this. He was on a very odd texture diet for 13 years, and he is only 4'10" at the age of 33. We do have some kids who are tube dependent, and I think we're seeing less of this because people are now starting to rely on things like Pediasure, and I'm not going to go into much about Pediasure, but you can see on the next slide that there's a whole lot of stuff in there that we don't even know what it is. And quite honestly, I don't want my kids to be eating this much processed, ingredients. I want my kids to be eating what I call whole food. Lastly, our kids begin to engage in big-time problem behaviors. And, this can include throwing the utensils, throwing the food, screaming, crying, holding their breath. I had a little boy who used to vomit every time food was presented. And we know that it was behavioral because he could control when he vomited. So soon, when mommy began to eat other foods, he started to vomit, even though he was never asked to eat those foods. And he shaked his mother to a point that she was only able to drink Coca-Cola. And so you know that there's a severe issue when the behaviors get that bad. Now, when I address feeding in my clinics, I want to make sure that my kids are eating a clean protein that is not processed and that is hormone-free. They're getting clean vegetables, again, that are not processed, that are fresh or frozen. And I say this because I work closely with a number of nutritionists, and they give me advice on an ongoing basis about the kinds of foods that are better than others. We want non-processed fruit. We don't want sugary, and we don't want fruits with added colors. So we want fresh fruit or frozen fruit. And then finally, we need whole grains rather than processed grains. And for many of our kids on the spectrum, they might have food allergies, and so this might include eliminating gluten, eliminating dairy, or eliminating rice or soy. And then lastly, we deal with the mental health aspect of the feeding problems, and it is the source of family stress. Even for my therapists who are highly trained to work with this, it is a source of stress for them too. So imagine as a parent or a caregiver the amount of stress you have around trying to get your child to eat. We all know that our kids need to eat healthy in order to grow and develop, and so the stress just becomes insurmountable. So you're probably asking yourself, should I get feeding therapy? And you have to ask, you know, a number of questions. Where is your child in the height and weight category? Is he or she in the normal range? I've worked with children who didn't even register on the height and weight chart because they were so underdeveloped. You also want to look at your child's skin color, and this is easy if the child is Caucasian or of Asian descent, but if your family has a darker skin tone, it's a lot more difficult to see that change. But for my kids who are light-skinned, I can actually see purple shiners underneath their eyes. So if they have those purple or dark spots under their eyes, that's a sign that something's up. Also, if my kids are really white-looking, and I don't mean because they're not getting the sun, and all of us in Connecticut are white right now, but I mean a very pale lack of color. And like I said, it's harder to detect that in children who have darker skin tones, but compare your child's skin tone to his or her siblings. If your child is much lighter in skin tone, that could be a sign that there's something medical going on. We also look at the number of foods, and I tell my families to count the numbers of foods that your kids eat. And by counting, chicken nuggets is one food, chicken breasts is another food, chicken from Kentucky Fried Chicken is a third food, okay? If your child is eating 10 foods or less, you need help, and you needed it yesterday. If your child is eating fewer than 20 foods, then you need help, and you might be able to get that help from another behavior analyst. In our experience, when the kids have limited themselves to that low, you start to see severe problem behaviors when you try to get them to eat new foods. We also look at textures. So, for example, if your child will not eat crunchy food or if your child only eats purees, that's probably an indicator that you need assistance. And, of course, if your child is gagging or hitting themselves or throwing up, which is emesis is another word for throwing up, those are also signs that you need help. Now, it's really important to understand that we have different types of feeding disorders. Someone will have to tell you what type of feeding disorder your child has. The physiological feeding disorder is, if you look at the root word, it's physical. That physiological is physical. That means something is structurally wrong with your child's body. We see this a lot in kids with Down syndrome who also have autism. We see this a lot in individuals who have cerebral palsy or also autism along with a CP. That means that their muscles or their coordination does not work properly to help them eat. Okay? Non-physiological problems are what we call the behavioral problems. They're the kids who are just finicky about how something smells or how something looks or how something feels. You also can have kids who have both, and we call that the combination. So a child with autism and Down syndrome is going to have mechanical issues, but because of some of the underlying autism issues, they may also have learned or developed some behavioral contingencies. So I have a little girl who will eat bananas at home, but if we try to get her to eat bananas in her child care center, you would think we're trying to cut off her arm. And so that tells us that she is mechanically completely okay with chewing bananas. It's the behavioral piece of chewing them at daycare. But but because of her Down syndrome, she also has difficulties managing larger bites or managing other types of textures because of her tongue and her mouth. And kids with autism often have very low cheek tone, and so you're going to have some oral motor issues associated with that. Now, on slide 16, you see a flow chart that really walks you through that process. So first, you have to get an assessment to find out what your child's feeding problem is. If it's physiological, your child is then going to get therapy to address those physical issues. That could be speech, and it could be OT, and it could be a combination of both. If it's non-physiological or behavioral, we call it, then your behavior analyst is going to help do a functional behavioral assessment to determine what the behavior is related to. Is your child avoiding certain foods? Is your child obtaining certain foods? And is your child getting undue attention? What I have seen in some of the cases that I've treated, there's a dog and pony show going on just to try to get the child to eat. Oh, and let's not forget, the child gets to dictate what's on the TV at all times, and the child refuses to eat anything if a certain TV show is not on. Now, for your combined kids, you need to have a team that's going to work well together. I have some OTs and some speech pathologists that I work closely with on my cases, because many of my kids, by the time they get to me, they do have multiple issues. They do have oral motor delays or oral motor sensitivities combined with some learned behavioral pieces. Now, before you do anything else, you have to make sure you've ruled out all the underlying issues. And today's talk does not let us go through all of those issues, but we are going to touch on the major ones. So we have medical issues. Now, this can be GI related, and we already know that a certain percentage of kids with autism have GI disease, and that could be Crohn's, it could be irritable bowel, it could be inflammatory bowel, it could be colitis, it could be reflux, it could be eosinophilic esophagitis. Okay, so there's a number of GI conditions that you need to make sure your child does not have. If there's a history of constipation, then that tells us that the GI tract is not working properly. Too often, we see children on Miralax, and I will get a kid who's six, and they've been on Miralax since they're two. And you can go to Miralax's website to read more about that product, but it's a chemical, all right? You're putting a chemical in your child's body to make them have a bowel movement when we know that there are other natural remedies that will help. Now, obviously, you're going to need to work with your healthcare practitioner to find out what is good for your child, but you can do things like fish oil, coconut oil, or natural calm, which is primarily a magnesium product. Another medical thing that you want to look at is food allergies. Now, a lot of people talk about gluten, and there's gluten allergy and there's gluten sensitivity. So if you have a gluten allergy, you have full-fledged celiac disease, and I see this more and more with my kids. In fact, one day I was in a presentation much like today, and the dad raised his hand and started asking questions, and I just looked at him and I said, that sounds like your child has celiac disease. And 2 months later, he emailed me and said, thank you, I took my child to the doctor and she has celiac. And so that means a lifelong avoidance of gluten. But your child might just have a gluten intolerance, so they're not processing the gluten appropriately. That's what I have. I've been gluten-free now for 6 years, and all kinds of positive things happened when I got off the gluten. There's another condition called PKU, and every single one of you, if you're on this call, I'm pretty sure your baby got a heel prick when they were born. That heel prick is testing for PKU. And when you have PKU, your body does not digest certain proteins. And so if you have PKU, you have to avoid certain proteins. And there's a whole list. You know, you can go to Wikipedia or other websites that will show you what proteins that you have to avoid if you have PKU. Another similar condition is maple syrup syndrome, where the child can't digest, again, certain proteins. And in both PKU and maple syrup, if you eat those proteins, your body can't digest it, and it crosses the blood-brain barrier and causes brain damage, lifelong brain damage. And so it's really important to check out what food allergies your child might have and to understand, that there could be long-term effects of eating foods that your child should not eat. So you can get this help from your allergist. You can get this help from your physician. And you can also ask specifically for what we call MRT testing. And what you want to find out is what foods cause an immediate reaction in my child and what foods cause a delayed reaction, like inflammation, because inflammation can lead to improper digestion and constipation. And all of that impacts your need to eat and the cravings that you have. You also want to get an appropriately trained nutritional person involved so you can make sure that your child has the right nutrients in his diet, his or her diet. Oftentimes we see major zinc deficiencies, calcium deficiencies, and magnesium deficiencies in children with autism. So if your child is deficient in those, you want to make sure that you supplement to make sure that your child is functioning properly. Now, some of you have probably heard about special diets, and the only thing I want to say about special diets is we don't start special diets to cure autism, okay? Special diets cure PKU, right? But special diets have not been proven to cure autism. What the special diets do is help the child feel better. And when you feel better, then you're going to be able to learn better. This is slide 24 is just an overview of the most common food allergies out there. Here in Connecticut, we have strict school rules about what can come to school, and these top food allergies are listed at, in the office, and then each classroom has a list of the food allergies that the kids have. I don't want to spend a lot of time on the special diets, but you have them in your handouts, and you can ask a nutritionist or your healthcare provider about those diets. So the GSDF, the SCT, the GAP. Okay? Now that addresses the medical things that you need to do. You also need to make sure that your child is structurally and mechanically okay. And you can have this done with your speech therapist. Occupational therapists are involved in most cases. You can get a swallow study done to make sure that everything's flowing through okay. You can have an oral motor assessment. They can look at, whether your child has the ability to chew. They will also look at some of the sensory processing. But all of that will need to be done before you try to start feeding therapy. And then, like I said earlier, your behavior analyst is going to help you do the behavior assessment. They will find out, why is your child engaging in these behaviors? Is it to escape a non-preferred food, get more of a preferred food, get attention, get TV. The other thing we do as a standard part of our treatment is we conduct a preference assessment. So we want to learn what are the kids willing to work for. And sometimes I will identify movies or iPad apps or music, and I will get the parent to put that thing in timeout for a short period before we start feeding therapy. And that makes the child even more motivated to work for it. Now, anytime a child has a behavior challenge, and feeding is just one type of behavior challenge, behavior analysts will develop what's called a behavior intervention plan. And across the board, every behavior intervention plan, or every BIP, looks to change the antecedents, which are the things that happen before the problem behavior. The behavior plan will also teach a new behavior. Now, usually in behavior plans, we're working on communication, and that's not the case when we move on to feeding. We also teach a replacement behavior. So what can we teach that child to do instead of the gagging, instead of the vomiting? And then we will modify the consequences, okay? If we look at on slide 31, when we have a BIP for feeding, We specifically focus on a few antecedents, and I'm going to go into those in more detail for you. We also teach new behaviors, which 99% of the time we teach acceptance. You need to accept this food that I'm giving you. We will also work on learning to hold a fork, learning to cut your food, learning to use a napkin, right? But those are secondary things to eating what is presented to you. And, of course, we always reinforce. And I'm going to go into detail on all of those. Now, this slide number 32, I presented in Dubai last year, and, of course, me not being very socially aware, did not take this cartoon out and realized I had offended a number of people. And what they didn't get is that a lot of people think when we do behavioral feeding that we restrain children in chairs and that we force feed them. And so I want to make it very clear that if you have a provider who is restraining your child or who wants to restrain your child or who forces food into the mouth, then you might want to look for a new provider because it is not necessary to restrain children to get an intervention to work, and it's certainly not necessary to force feed them, okay? And you can email me if you have questions about that, and for providers, if you need assistance, you can email me as well, but it is just not good practice to restrain and force feed. Okay, now, some of the antecedent modifications that we're going to go over are listed on slide 33, so I'm just going to go right on to slide 34 and talk about those. Feeding therapy, you're already under a great deal of stress. And so when you get ready to begin feeding therapy, it is going to be single-handedly the most stressful thing you've ever done other than give birth to your child. It is extremely stressful for everybody. The parents are stressed, the therapists are stressed, and the child is stressed. And so you want to make sure that everybody that's doing this is ready for that stress. I often tell the parents that I work with to identify what they're working for. Are you going to get a massage on Saturday when we're finished? Are you going to get a pedicure, a manicure, a date night, football tickets? Because it's important to know that there is something down the line that's going to be reinforcing. Now, I know you're thinking, if my child would just eat broccoli, or if my child would just eat meat, you know, I get that that is rewarding enough in and of itself, but I think it's also helpful to have a secondary reinforcer for you. Now, if the child is of a certain age, I tell them what's about to go down. I think it's only fair. And so that includes the use of a social story or putting it on a calendar to let them know that it's going to happen. And feeding therapy is not something that you do occasionally. Once you embark on feeding therapy, it is a lifelong change. And think about that the same way, you know, that you might think about a long-term weight loss program. You don't just sometimes diet. Losing weight is really about a lifelong change, portion control, the types of food that you eat. And so the same thing here. The strategies that you learn in behavioral feeding are now going to become a part of your life. You also want to make sure that your environment is appropriate. And we look at a number of things. So slide 36 shows you that you have to have the right seating. You can't be in a chair that's too big. You can't be in a chair that's too small. You should not be eating on the floor. Meal times are supposed to happen at the table, and so it's really good to learn that skill. And unfortunately, I'm not a fan of school cafeterias, and so that's more like a picnic table. So once you learn how to eat at a table, then you have to learn to eat, you know, at different kinds of tables. You also want to make sure that you have a good set of utensils that you're going to use and teach your child to use. Obviously, the ones that are pictured here are more for younger children, but I'm going to highlight the ones in the left picture, the metal ones. I try not to use metal utensils during feeding therapy, and this is for child safety and for therapist safety because metal hurts when you get stabbed. And my staff have been stabbed a number of times with sharp forks. Also, if you're trying to help a child to take a bite, you don't want the child to get poked inadvertently by a fork. So try to use round, rubber, safe utensils. The same thing goes for cups. When I start behavioral feeding therapy, bottles are bye-bye, and so are sippy cups. Children need to learn to drink from an open mouth cup. I allow sippy cups only when the child is in the car to avoid spillage. The rest of the time, the child needs to drink from an open mouth cup, and that's going to help oral motor that will then go on to help your child's language skills. Now, with dishes, some parents like to use those dishes that have suction cups on the bottom. The bottom line is I like to use a lot of different dishes so that the child learns to eat off of everything. I try not to use partitions because it is really okay if the food touches each other. But during feeding therapy, I have multiple of everything because, lo and behold, something is going to get dumped or thrown, so you need to have backup pretty handy. And then, of course, I show the classic school cafeteria that I despise. It's just too loud and too big for many of our little children, and it is not a really good place to learn to eat. Eventually, we want our kids to be able to eat there, but initially it's just too difficult. So slide 42 really shows you this is what feeding should look like. You should see happy babies that are ready for foods to come. You should also see faces. Children make faces when they eat foods that have a new taste, and that's a good thing. That doesn't mean stop offering that food. The palate will open up. And we know that kids need to sample food. Typical kids need to sample food about 5 different times before it will become a preferred acceptable food. So now think about how many times that means a child with autism needs to sample it, okay? You divide that, you multiply that exponentially. It just takes repetition in order for it to become a comfortable food. And oftentimes our kids with autism miss this whole food exploration stage. And so it is okay for kids to get messy. It is okay for them to spill. Their fine motor in their hands, their fine motor in their mouth will all improve with this practice. Once we get the environment ready, then we move on to some clear rules. And by that, we must sit when we eat. We have that rule for our kids. They like to get up and run around, and they even do this thing where they, oops, I have to go to the bathroom. And we squashed it all. We said, nope, you go to the bathroom before you come to the table, wash your hands, and then you're going to sit for the whole meal. And you're going to sit until we finish. We're going to talk, and we're going to have a meal. But that also means appropriate manners, using your utensils, using your napkin. We don't lick the dishes. We don't spill on the floor and then put it in our mouth. We don't spill on the table and then put it in our mouth. And when you tell me you're done, you're done. You don't get to come back in 30 minutes and ask for chips. You don't get to come back in 30 minutes and ask for, you know, some other French fries or some other preferred food. You're going to eat what we offer. Now, I want you all, I know you can't tell me, but I want you all to stop and think for just a moment. When you are getting ready to try a new food, how do you try it? Do you order the food off the menu for the first time and get you a pickle plate of it? Heck no, you don't. You try a new food in very small portions, and you try a new food in a safe place. Okay? So we have to make sure that when we start introducing children to new foods, that we do it in the same way that we try new foods. And I go by that same, the golden rule, do unto others. Do unto your children the way that you would want it done to you. And in ABA terms, that means you present one bite of food, the child gets to try the food, and then they get something great, okay? We also do, we mess with what behavior analysts call establishing operations. Now, that it's a fancy term that we can talk about some other time, but most importantly, your child is not going to want to try new foods if he's not hungry. You don't try new foods when you're not hungry. Often we don't even eat when we're not hungry, so your child has to be hungry. If he's snacking on pretzels all day or if he's snacking on goldfish all day, he's not going to be hungry. And also, if your child's ABA program uses food all day, you've got yourself a problem. So you want to make sure that your child is not eating all day long and only eating at specified mealtime. We have a consistent mealtime. So breakfast is a certain time, lunch is a certain time, and dinner's at a certain time. During feeding therapy, so not during life, but during feeding therapy, we don't offer snacks because we want to make sure that they're good and hungry. But once we've addressed the feeding behavior, then we move on to three meals a day plus two snacks, at least two snacks. Now, we don't, during feeding therapy, there's no food or drink 2 hours before or after the treatment session. And we do that to make sure that Johnny doesn't learn, well, Mommy's just going to feed me when Missy's finished. Okay, so it's really important to teach the contingencies that you will eat when Missy's feeding you and you don't get to eat again until the next session. We also limit liquid consumption to a certain extent. Back when I was doing therapy back in Austin, it gets hot down there, and so you don't want to limit liquid because you don't want to get heat stroke or dehydration. But you also don't want the child to be full on liquids, and you certainly don't want them to have liquid that they're going to then vomit up if a food becomes, if they try to get rid of a food that's in their mouth. We also do this thing called reinforcer deprivation, where we take something that the child really, really, really likes, and we put it in timeout for about 2 weeks before intervention. And then, again, that just makes the child motivated to work to get that thing. So my first ever intensive feeding therapy little guy, he loved Dora. He loved, loved, loved Dora. And so Mom put all of his Dora videos in timeout. And about 2 or 3 days into the timeout, she called me and she said, "Can we still watch Diego?" And I said, "Well, if he's making you crazy, yes, you can go ahead and watch Diego because I really need Dora to be my bomb." And as it turned out, Dora was definitely the bomb. He would watch Diego, but not to the extent that he loved Dora. So he was willing to eat in order to get access to Dora. Now, those things alone are not enough. Okay, those are just the things that you do to get ready for the therapy to work. It's really difficult to have your child get hungry because you want your child to eat, you want your child to gain weight, and if they come to you and they're begging for that pretzel, or they're begging for that chip, or they're begging for that McDonald's French fry, it's really hard to say no. But once you learn how to say no and work through all that crying and tantruming, then it just gets easier from there. I have to point out here that if your child is restricted to, you know, 5 or 6 foods, then you need to prepare for withdrawal symptoms, okay? Think about what a heroin addict does when they come off of heroin. There are massive, massive, massive withdrawals. And so you want to make sure that you're ready for those food withdrawals. We've now seen it in 4 different kids. We had one little girl who was living off of Sonic grilled cheese sandwiches, and she withdrew for about 2 days, and then on the 3rd day we started getting life out of her. We had another little boy who was also addicted to Sonic grilled cheese. I know, like, what do they put in there, right? But he had vomiting and lethargy as part of his withdrawal symptoms. We had a little boy who was living off of one kind of bread and French fries. He threw up for 4 days as he was going out of his withdrawal symptoms. So you really want to make sure that you have medical support if your child is severely limited. Now, I've talked a little bit about what behaviors we focus on, and those are listed on slide 49. When we teach those behaviors, in behavior analysis terms, we use shaping, modeling, prompting, and fading. So for shaping, we take variations of accept. And that could be touch it to your lip, touch it to your tongue, just put it in and spit it out. The important thing is we get compliance. So we teach the child to do one step before we move on to the next. And we pair that with lots of reinforcement. We also model. We show them, this is how you touch it to your tongue. See, it's not that bad. Or this is how you spit it in the trash can. Now, if you do allow spitting, you want to make sure that you make it clear when spitting is no longer allowed. We do prompting. So we will take the child's hand and put it on the fork. We'll hold the child's hand around the fork and help them feed themselves. We sometimes will tap at the plate like it's time to take your bite, or we'll open our mouths really wide to show them, open your mouth like this. In size fading, we start with very small bites of food so that they learn that it's okay, and then we gradually make it get bigger. So on slide 55, you see the for a regular bite size, we let them touch it to their lip and touch it to their tongue and put it in and spit it out. But when it's time to chew and swallow, we go with very, very small bites, just like you try a new food. So slide 56 shows you an adult-sized bite. Slide 57 shows you some child-sized bites. Those are Zoopals, Zoopals utensils. I really like them because of the colors and the animals, and they're not very sharp, so no one gets hurt. If you have to do texture fading, so you start with puree, your next step is finely chopped, like a food processor chopped, and then you can do hand chopped and then bite size. And lastly, with our reinforcers, like I said, we do lots and lots and lots of reinforcement. One kind of reinforcement is DRA, differential reinforcement of alternative behavior. When you touch it to your lip, then you get 30 seconds of DORA. When you put it in your mouth, then you get 30 seconds of DORA. We try to use reinforcers that have an off and on switch that we can control. And I've listed a few of the things that we like to do on the iPad because those tend to work best for us. Attention also is a very good thing. We say, nice work, super job, high five, and generally a cheer session for when they do what we need them to do. Sometimes we do this thing called sequential reinforcement. So when you eat this green bean, then I'll let you have some McDonald's chicken nuggets. I hate McDonald's chicken nuggets, but in some really, 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 really tough cases, I might use them. In some rare cases, and I think we've done this with two of the kids we've treated, we actually put the two foods on there together. So we had a little boy, he was learning to eat salmon, and he was learning to eat mango, but he really liked to have his fruits mixed with everything, and so we put the salmon and the mango on the bite together. We will often take a preferred chip or a preferred pretzel and put it in a non-preferred healthy food like hummus or guacamole. Very rarely, but occasionally, we use negative reinforcement. And just so you understand what that means, when the child takes the bite, we let them get up from the table and run around. Okay? We don't do it often because then you have to get the child back to the table. But in some severe cases, the table is so uncomfortable for the child that they need to run around before they come back and try it again. But over time, they learn to sit at the table for the whole meal. The last technique that we use is called escape extinction. And basically what that means is once you say, we're going to try green beans, then you must effectively try green beans. And that's why it's important to think about shaping. So instead of you're going to eat this green bean or you're going to stay at the table until tomorrow, right? Think of it easier. Like, you know, I just need you to take that green bean and touch it up to your lip, and then I'll let you have your french fry. Okay? And the more they do that, the more comfortable they get with green bean. And when they're really good with green bean, then you can do touch it to the tongue. All right, see? Green bean is fine. So now I need you to lick it. And once they're really good at licking it, then you're going to go to putting it in the mouth and possibly spitting it out. So you have to remember, don't ask your child to do something unless you're going to actually follow through. And, of course, then in ongoing therapy, you can do the new foods program as part of your regular ABA program. It's not as stressful as doing an intensive boot camp for feeding. We typically treat kids in 5 days or less, but that's, you know, 3 sessions a day for 5 days, so it's very, very stressful. But if you do it ongoing as part of your ABA or as part of your school program, then it's not as stressful. You also don't make the same progress, you know, that you make in intensive. But just like everything else, the more you do it, the faster you learn. We know that. I think that's the last thing. Oh, I know. I wanted to go over the funding, and then we'll stop for questions. So if you have the right kind of health insurance coverage, and you have to check with your state and with your policy to know whether you have the right kind, you could potentially get funding for ABA therapy to address feeding. If you don't have insurance funding, you can also get it to be a part of your child's IEP or their IFSP if they're under 3. You have to address it as a functional skill, and you have to talk about how it affects your child's education. If he's not eating, he's not learning. And lunch or snack is a part of every school day, so it's definitely an essential component. And then finally, you need to check with your state because there may be some state grants available for you through the state developmental disability centers or through some nonprofits. And then I'm going to leave slide 76 sort of right there in front of you. That's the resources that you might need if you decide to go a behavioral feeding route. And with that, Lauren, I think we can go to the next step.
To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. At this time, we will conduct a brief survey. After I finish reading the entire question and all of the possible responses, please answer by pressing the star key followed by the number that corresponds to your choice. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Question 1. This session provided me with information about feeding problems for a child with an autism spectrum disorder. Press star 1, strongly agree. Press star 2. Agree. Press star 3. Disagree. Press star 4. Strongly disagree. Please vote now. And we are still gathering additional responses. Question number 2. This session educated me on behavioral interventions for children with feeding problems. Press star 1, strongly agree. Press star 2, agree. Press star 3, disagree. Press star 4, strongly disagree. Please vote now. Question number 3. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following responses. Press star 1, strongly agree. Press star 2, agree. Press star 3, disagree. Press star 4, strongly disagree. Please vote now. Question number 4. I would recommend this program to others. Press star 1 if you agree, or press star 2 if you do not agree. Please vote now. Question 5. Please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with autism. Press star 1. I am the parent of a child with autism. Press star 2. I am a family member of a child who has autism. Press star 3. Other. Please vote now. Thank you for your feedback and for participating in our program. If you would like to make any additional comments to help us improve this program or have any questions on today's topic, press star 1 to have your line opened into the conference. Please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Please state your name before posing your question. Once again, press star 1 if you have a question or comment at this time, and we'll pause for just a moment to assemble the queue. As a reminder, that is star 1 if you have a question or comment on today's call. And we'll take our first question. Caller, please state your name.
Hi, my name is Nick. And I actually have two questions. One, I wanted to see if there's a link somewhere online to get a copy of the slides that were used in the presentation. I think that would be helpful. That wasn't able to get it. And then kind of a second question is kind of related to the funding. Wanted to see, again, kind of what else is potentially out there, because I know from personal experience that, you know, Cigna does not deem feeding therapy as something medically necessary. It's deemed, you know, experimental, so it's not covered through that. So wanted to see if you had any additional info about kind of other resources that are out there, other ways to, you know, potentially cover this cost, which could be, you know, significant.
Lauren, do you want to talk about the handout?
Sure. You can find the handout at www.cigna.com/autism. And there's going to be a link under the current topics that states, help, my child is a picky eater. And if you click on that, it does have the handout for today.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. And I do want to let you know, in regards to your other question, if you do have specific questions about additional resources, you are also welcome to call the number on the back of your insurance card, and one of our autism teammates will be able to assist you.
Okay. That's what I wanted to
see.
Yep.
Can I just add also, if you live in a state where there is an autism mandate, it's coded as ABA therapy. But again, even if you live in a state with a mandate, it does not mean that the family is going to have that as part of their plan. So it's a two-step process. You have to live in a state with a mandate, and the family has to have the appropriate plan under that state mandate.
That's correct. Yeah, I think our issue is the second of those. So.
Yeah. Okay. And so it's usually self-funded. If people have self-funded insurance, it does not generally cover ABA therapy. And that's when I would move on to step 2, which is the IEP. Because, and you can email me directly. I'll be happy to walk you through how we get it done through IEPs.
Okay. Yeah, that might be an option. Thank you very much.
And my email is on the handout.
Okay.
As a reminder, that is star 1 if you have a question or comment at this time, and we'll pause again for just another moment. And there are no further questions in the queue at this time.
Okay, thank you so much for attending, and thank you, Missy, for providing such wonderful insights. Again, if you have questions about therapies discussed today, please contact the autism team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Please be sure to mark your calendars to join us for our next Autism Awareness Seminar that will be on February 14th at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time or 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, when we will be discussing talking to your child about autism, when, how often, and how. Thank you and have a good day.
Thank you.